Hi, Dr. Dave here for our sponsor, Brookstone.com. You probably know what a gadget guy I am. One of my favorite places to visit at the mall has always been the Brookstone store because they have all these unique gadgets. And now you can find all those gadgets and more at Brookstone.com and support this show by ordering there and saving yourself 10% using our special discount code SHOWRAP. Spelled S-H-O-W-R-A-P. Now, on with the show.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 88, Peak Performance Sports Psychology, May 6, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Absolutely. This information applies at any level, whether you're a student performing at that level, or whether you're a musician, or a surgeon, or an athlete. It's the ability to recognize when you're off task, recognize when you're distracted, and be able to refocus on really what's important in related to that performance. That's across the board, you know, whether you're doing, you know, whether you're making a formula for a new drug, or whether you're studying for a test, or whether you're getting ready to play a basketball game. Those concepts are universal and across the board in terms of focusing.
That was the voice of my guest, Patrick Cohn, Ph.D. Sports psychology expert Dr. Patrick Cohn has been an athlete and a coach. According to his website, he's experienced firsthand how beliefs, attitudes, and behaviors influence performance. His passion for sports was born early in life and grew as he participated in sports such as football, hockey, baseball, lacrosse, racquetball, and golf. After competing in sports for many years, Dr. Cohn went on to study and research how mental attitudes shape physical performance, and he earned a Ph.D. in applied sports psychology. The more he studied champion athletes and their mindsets, the more he realized that winning attitudes are the key to performing well in competition. Dr. Cohn has dedicated his mental game coaching practice to helping coaches, athletic trainers, and parents of aspiring athletes. He's the president and founder of Peak Performance Sports in Orlando, Florida. He is considered a leading authority on mental skills for entering the zone and pre-performance routines, largely based on his extensive research. He is a mentor to many in the field of sports psychology and provides performance enhancement skills through mental game coaching for individual and team athletes. In fact, he has consulted with high-profile teams such as the Miami Dolphins, NASCAR winners, national motocross champions, and PGA Tour professional golfers such as Brian Watts and J.L. Lewis. He's also worked with powerful corporations such as IBM and USA Today. In addition to his work with athletes, Dr. Cohn has been a sports commentator on the Golf Channel. For more information, you can visit his website at www.peaksports.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Patrick Cohn, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm really glad that you could make it. I want to start off talking about the field of sports psychology generally, because you're a sports psychologist, and I think people would like to know more about the field. So, first of all, what is a sports psychologist?
Well, a sports psychologist, or what I call a mental game coach, is someone that works on the mental preparation components for an athlete, such as helping them to focus better, concentrate better, helping them to improve their confidence, deal with setbacks and distractions, and stay composed in sport. But you can look at it from different perspectives. I mean, there's researchers out there that are actively looking at, on the research side, they're looking at how psychological behaviors and thoughts influence performance. And then there's applied people like myself that are actually working with athletes and helping athletes reach their peak potential in sports.
Right. Yeah, I figured there probably would be a division of applied versus academic. I know that's true in my own field of clinical psychology. Give us a sense of what some of the on the research side, I know you're on the applied side and we're going to be investigating that quite a bit. What's been going on in the research side or the more academic side of the field?
Well, on the more academic or the research side, what they want to do, just like in your field, is they want where they can validate, look at studies where they can actually validate some of the concepts that are going on. They look at state and trait anxiety, for example, and how that may affect athletic performance. Or they'll look at self-efficacy, for example, and they'll study self-efficacy, find out, you know, does that have is there differences in athletes, and does that have an effect on performance? They'll look at various visualization techniques and how that may have an impact on performance as well. And there's a lot of other areas on the fringe in terms of looking at participation, you know, and why kids stay involved in sports and things like that as well.
You know, that you just sparked something. It may be a little bit tangential, but I saw an article in the paper yesterday about PE in school, you know, physical exercise, and in a lot of ways that's kind of declined. And I was reading that there's a video game system that people have been adapting. I think it's called Dance, Dance, Dance or something like that. They've got this program, and the kids are just loving dancing, partly, I think, because of the non-competitive nature of it.
Yeah. And I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with competition. I think if it's done in the right way, competition can actually spur kids on and can spur athletes on. And what I mean by competition is, and I think generally athletes use that as a motivator, from my perspective, is they love really to compete against others. They love the intensity. They love the adrenaline, that competition. Now, earlier on, there's some kids that maybe aren't as self-confident in their abilities, and they shy away from that competitive experience.
Yes.
So, but it's to succeed in sports, you do need a competitive spirit. You need to embrace and enjoy competition.
Right, right. And many people do, and certainly some people don't, probably for the kinds of reasons that you just discussed. Getting back to the field generally, I'm wondering if there are any different schools of thought or any sort of major conflicts that cleave the field. You know, often in a field there will be opposing sides or different points of view. What are the polarities within sports psychology, if any?
Well, you know, I've been out of academia. I used to teach at the... I've been out of academia so long that I don't really stay up with all the research and from the academic side. But I guess an ongoing that we started to talk about is researchers in sports psychology feel like that you first need to research and validate what you're doing before you go and you take it out to working with athletes on the applied level. Now, the people like myself that are doing applied work feel like it's all about gaining experience and finding out what works, using an eclectic approach and finding out what works with athletes. And that's kind of the theory that I ascribe to, is use what works with athletes. And based upon my experience over the last, 15, 16 years working with athletes, I've found a system based upon my experience of helping athletes that I know works.
Well, I want to get into that system in just a moment. You mentioned you've been doing it for 15 or 16 years. How old would you say the field of sports psychology is? How long has it been around?
Well, it depends how you define that, because you could go back and you could say Newt Rockne, for example, in football was, you know, a sports psychologist in his own right. Great coaches from the past were sports psychologists in their own right. Why? Because they knew how to motivate athletes, because they knew how to get athletes into a confident state of mind. They knew what to say to them before competition to get them ready. So, I mean, you can go back many, many years ago, 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago. I think modern sports psychology has been around for about 30 years, I would say.
Yeah, because I'm thinking, you know, particularly of PhD psychologists such as yourself. I know the American Psychological Association has 50-plus different divisions. I don't know if there's a division of sports psychology. Is there, or is there some other professional organization?
There is out there, and I'm not, let's just clear it up, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a licensed psychologist, and that's why I don't advertise I'm a sports psychologist. I call myself a mental game coach or a master mental game coach because I teach other people my system, but there's the Association for the Advancement of Applied Sports Psychology, that's called ASP. And then there's Division 47, I believe, of the APA, which is the sports psychology, the American Psychological Association, arm, you could say. So, from both perspectives, in terms of what group is leading the field, I don't know. I think both of them are kind of doing their own thing and not necessarily communicating too much with each other. But so those are the two main bodies that you have that are governing this whole area of sports psychology. You can become a certified consultant for ASP or Applied Sports Association for Applied Sports Psychology. Now, I'm not as familiar with Division 47 of the APA, because I am not a member of the APA.
Okay, I made a mistake. I just assumed, because I saw on your website, Dr. Patrick Cohen, I assumed that you had a PhD in psychology.
Very good question. No, I came through the different route, which is through physical education and exercise science. There is two different routes that you can take in sports psychology, and one is through sports and movement and physical education, exercise science, physical therapy. That's the route I came up through. And then there's the whole clinical route where you can go and you can become a trained, you know, a licensed psychologist, but you can have you can have a track as your education. You can have a track in sports psychology.
Okay.
That's a completely different avenue.
I see.
Someone that would be more in the APA, Division 47 of the APA.
Well, that's good to know, because some people that listen to the show are still in the formative stages of their education and career. So if there are people who are interested in following in your footsteps, they'll know that there are at least two different paths that they could follow, one going through psychology and the other going through a physical education, coming more out of a strong sports background. So I noticed on your website that you've worked with sports teams. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Yes. And that's primarily what I do. I mean, primarily what I do is I offer a service to athletes and teams. And what I'll typically do is I'll have them, let's say I'm working with an individual athlete, for example, I'll have them complete my assessment, which is called my AMAP, my athlete's mental aptitude profile. This isn't a validated or a standardized test. This is a simple 5-page test that I developed based upon my experience of some of the mental game challenges that prior students have had.
So what kinds of issues would you be assessing there? What, give us a sense of what some of the questions might be.
And notice I call them students and not clients, because it's very educational in nature. This is not psychopathology at all. It's very educational. It's mental skills training and oriented. What I test for is I look at, number one, I look at kind of their goals and how specific their goals are. do they have a direction where they're going? I ask broad questions about their understanding of the mental game. What type of challenges do they feel like they have? Some athletes will come here, they know exactly what challenges they have. Others, they don't, and I need to help them uncover some of the challenges or blocks that they have in their performance. Sometimes I'll get an athlete that just wants to get better, and that's the ideal situation, is an athlete will come in and just want to improve and isn't slumping. Unfortunately, in my field, we're the last resort. We're the last frontier for a slumping athlete or an athlete that's having trouble with their performance. And so they'll find a mental coach to help them climb out of that slump. And that's really unfortunate, because my field about performance enhancement and improving mental skills is just another aspect of coaching and improvement and education, and that's how I look at it. I also look at their confidence. I look at what type of doubts they have about their sport. I look at their composure and their ability to let go of mistakes, their expectations, and if they have any limiting expectations or beliefs that are holding them back. I'll ask a little bit about their practice, a little bit about their routines for their pregame warm-up. So it's very comprehensive in terms of, you know, what I'm looking at. I'll even look at things like social approval, for example, and just how much concern they have for other people in their life and how that may affect their sport performance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that all makes a lot of sense. Now, what about when you're working with a team? I would imagine that there'd be unique challenges in working with a group of people as opposed to an individual person.
Absolutely, and I do the same process. I start with a simple one-page evaluation. I get a sense for what's going on with the team. I'll talk with the coaches or the coach, get a sense from the coach, and then I'll develop a unique program for that specific team. And because you're working with a team, now you've got group dynamics.
Yes.
And as soon as you throw in group dynamics, you have to look into a lot of other areas, such as communication is really huge in group dynamics, looking at communication between athletes, coach-athlete communication, athlete-coach communication, teamwork. The big buzzword in this area is team cohesion, and how apt that the members of the group are able to stick together when challenged. So that's huge. Leadership, both from a coaching perspective and from an internal leadership, is also very important when talking about team dynamics. So yes, primarily, you know, you're working both in performance enhancement, mental skills such as confidence and focusing and composure, and then you're also working in the teamwork aspects. Most of the time, coaches will bring me in to work on the performance enhancement of the individual athletes, mm-hmm. and not so much the teamwork. There are people out there that are specializing in this area of just working in the area of teamwork and leadership and communication. I guess if you were to say what my specialty is, it would be more on the performance enhancement side, working on confidence and focus, composure, trust, mental preparation techniques.
Okay, and what are some of the sports teams that you've worked with or the sports? Are we talking football or tennis teams or baseball teams or what?
I have worked with baseball teams here at the college level and also at the grade school level and high school level. I've worked with the Miami Dolphins, one of the professional teams. I came in and worked with their coaching staff a couple of years ago. I've done a lot of work with golf teams because I published several golf books, and that was my original claim to fame, if I can say, is I published 4 golf books, and I've worked with a lot of tour professional golfers on an individual level. So that, you know, transferred into working with teams as well. Mostly at the collegiate level, I find that those are the coaches that are most likely to bring in a mental coach or a sports psychologist to work with their team. So, various teams, mostly in golf, baseball, and a little bit of football.
Okay. Can I assume that golf is your sport then?
It is. I mean, it's a specialty area of mine. Golf is a specialty area of mine. But today I work with athletes and teams of all levels. Specifically, I work with racing teams quite a bit. Another specialty of mine is also working with motocross and auto racers. So that's another kind of a specialty. But I work with tennis players, basketball players, you name it. I have skaters that I work with, individual athletes on that side. So it seems like a lot of the individual athletes will gravitate towards working with me. But I also work with individual athletes from teams as well, like in tennis and baseball and hockey and the whole gamut.
Well,
I started in the area of golf.
Uh-huh. Well, it sounds like it's not boring. It sounds like it's very varied.
It's never ending. I mean, it's you can always, find new avenues and new things to do. We're constantly working on producing the best mental game products we can that are very applied in nature and that are very simple for even young athletes to understand. I recently co-authored a book called The Ultimate Sports Parent with my sister, who is Lisa Cohn. She's a writer herself. So what we're trying to disseminate the information even down to parents now, and helping parents, transfer some of the mental skills to young athletes. And we're finding that that's an area that's exploding right now, the whole sports parenting thing. And there's not a lot of material out there. There's been a couple of books written that you can find. But we did a real practical and applied CD program and workbook program. So there's always opportunities to do real applied and specific products, and we're expanding on that. Every day we're expanding. We're looking for challenges that coaches have, that athletes have, that sports parents have, that will help them, in their careers.
Yes, I notice you have a lot of products on your website. It's very entrepreneurial website. You've got a lot going on there. One of the things you talk about there is developing mental toughness, and I guess maybe that's one of the skills that you're referring to. What do you mean by mental toughness, and how do you help people develop that?
Well, mental toughness is a very broad term that we use, and it relates once again to performance enhancement. For example, mental toughness relates to an athlete's level of confidence. If you go up to bat, or if you go to hit a shot, or if you go to hit a tennis serve, if you don't have complete confidence and conviction in your ability and your skills, most likely that's going to show up in your performance. So one of the areas we look at is helping athletes improve their confidence and keep their confidence when they're challenged by mistakes or adversity or failure, for example. So that would be one component of mental toughness that we're looking at and helping athletes improve. But you can look at the whole gamut, staying focused under adversity, staying focused under pressure, staying composed under pressure, and not getting affected by fear of failure or, other mental game challenges that we see. So mental toughness is just an athlete's ability to be confident and focused and composed in competition and not let their mental game get in their own way, as we say.
Yes. Now, maybe that ties into, I know, you've done some work for some major corporations such as IBM.
Yeah, that was IBM Canada had brought me in to do some seminars. And we can definitively say that the mental skills that we're working on with athletes apply to any career, any performance, as long as you're talking about performance. I don't care if it's surgery, and I know colleagues of mine that have worked with surgeons or if it's musicians, and colleagues of mine have worked with musicians, or students. My material is being used to work with students as well. When you talk about focusing, when you talk about confidence, and then you talk about composure and mental preparation and all those skills, I mean, don't they apply across the board to any career?
Yes, yeah.
Certainly. I teach my system to coaches. I have a program, I don't know if you ran across it, it's called the MGCP program. That's my mental game coaching professional certification that I do. It's an intensive 10 or 20-week course that I do with coaches. I've had psychologists that have been in it. I've had therapists in it. And one of these, a grade school coach that works in the area of lacrosse and is also a teacher at the grade school level, he took the material in the MGCP program, and he does a course for students called Mental Coaching for Students or Mental Training for Students. So absolutely, this information applies at any level, whether you're a student performing at that level or whether you're a musician or a surgeon or an athlete or any other career. I've done seminars for Bayer Labs, for example. They brought me in, just wanted me to talk about how I can improve concentration and focus and remove some of the distraction that they have, you know, in their work.
So what would you tell them in a situation like that?
Well, once again, I did an assessment. We did a full-blown survey and assessment, and we found out what were the challenges that they were having, when were these distractions and the challenges, what things did they bring in from their life to work that were challenges. So we did a full-blown assessment and tried to get as much information as we can related to concentration, focusing, and refocusing. And then I would go in and do the seminar with them, talking about how to have a routine to improve your focus, how to identify what's important to focus on. We call those task-relevant performance cues. How to identify what the distractions are. I presented the results of the survey. And then give them a specific technique for being able to refocus when they're distracted. And that's what it really comes down to. Everybody gets distracted. It's the ability to recognize when you're off task, recognize when you're distracted, and be able to refocus on really what's important in related to that performance. That's across the board, you know, whether you're doing, you know, whether you're making a formula for a new drug or whether you're studying for a test or whether you're getting ready to play a basketball game. Those concepts are universal and across the board in terms of focusing. I try to make it really simple and really basic and don't throw a lot of psychological jargon at athletes because sometimes they don't understand that, or you may turn off some people when you start throwing around a lot of jargon that they can't really relate to. So I try to make it really simple for them to understand at a basic level and to be able to apply it easily as well.
Yes, yes. Your mentioning of focus reminds me of one of your newsletters. I'm now on your newsletter list, and I saw one recently about being in the zone, which reminded me of psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, work, he's written books on flow, which is, I think, partly where that, at least some of the academic concept around the idea of being, quotes, in the zone comes from. How do you promote flow or being in the zone? Maybe you could say a little bit about what that is for our listeners, too.
Absolutely. Csikszentmihalyi, who wrote the book Flow, The Psychology of Optimal, I think it's Experience, great material. I use it all the time in my work. He actually speaks at the ASP conference that they have. They typically bring him in to talk. And I've heard him speak live. I've read his books, and the material is right on in terms of helping athletes as well. And he talks, flow is basically a concept of becoming totally immersed into what you're doing in the moment and how people in their life find enjoyment from that process of being fully immersed and fully engrossed into the moment and what they're doing. And to perform your best, it's kind of a Zen approach. To perform your best, you have to be fully immersed into what you're doing. If you're distracted or your mind is elsewhere, you're not going to be. And he talks about some of the prerequisites for getting into this state of flow, which I call a mini zone. And anybody can be in this state of flow, as he talks about. But it's that if you have clear goals and you're getting clear feedback about how you're doing and you're fully immersed into the present moment and you lose the sense of being self-conscious, he says it's more likely that you're going to enter the state of being into the state of flow. So flow is very much about a concentrated state of being.
Yes, yes, and you mentioned Zen, which reminded me of another important book, which I wouldn't be surprised if it influenced you at some point. It was in the, I think, the early 70s that Tim Galway wrote Inner Tennis.
The Inner Game of Tennis,
yes,
and he wrote The Inner Game of Golf as well.
Okay.
I recommend it to many of my students that come in, my athletes that come in and work with me. The Inner Game of Tennis is a classic, and that really started this whole, I don't want to say revolution, but that really kick-started sports psychology. He was kind of one of the original fathers, I guess you could say, of sports psychology and coming out with a mass market paperback. And The Inner Game of Tennis, written by Tim Galloway, it's all about tapping into your creative part of your mind rather than your analytical part of your mind. So he talks about self one versus self two and how in order to perform better, you have to suspend self one, your analytical mindset, while self two, your more your creative, natural, instinctive part of you can perform. And So that was kind of really revolutionary at that time in the mid-70s, him coming out with that information. He found it out by just working with beginning tennis players. He had found out if he gave beginning tennis players a simple, you could say a mantra, it's not a mantra, but it, you know, a simple saying that would suspend their trying mind or their analytical mind, he found out they were able to perform better in that situation when they just let their body react and do what, you know, he was training them to do. So it was all experiential on his part as being a tennis coach. And it was very kind of intuitive, and maybe he had read up on some of the left brain, right brain material or research that was out there to, you know, kind of spark him with the idea. And today we call it the training mindset, or the practice mindset, which is his self one, and self two is what we call the performance mindset or the trusting mindset. So there's a translation today that I use as well from that material. So I recommend anybody that's interested in performance enhancement studying how that concept works to go and pick up The Inner Game of Tennis.
That's great. I didn't realize quite how formative and important his work was in the field. I know it did influence me, tennis being one of the sports that I was involved in earlier years, never at a really competitive level, but still at my own level, I was able to try out some of his ideas and certainly experience those wonderfully delicious, all too rare moments of flow where everything just clicked and was effortless. And, you know, that's a wonderful experience when it happens.
Right.
Since I'm name dropping here, I guess. I wonder if you're familiar with Michael Murphy. He wrote a book called Golf in the Kingdom. As a golfer, if you don't know that book, I would really recommend it.
Yes, Golf in the Kingdom. I'm not really familiar. I've heard of the book, and I probably read it many years ago. But that's a classic as well. There's so many golf books out there that are more on the kind of the mental or you could say, spiritual side. That's, that book, I think, is more like a mental game, spiritual type
book. Yes,
there's so many mental game books out there today on the mental game of golf. It's incredible. It's getting to a place where it's overcrowded. You know, it's hard to determine what's, you know, what are the really good publications out there and what aren't good.
Yeah. I really recommend Michael Murphy to you. He's got a newer book called The Future of the Body. And I think he also wrote one earlier called In the Zone. But The Future of the Body is like this compendium, I think, of mind-body material, covers a lot of research, and also sort of looks into the future, as I recall. It's been a while since I looked at it, but he's an interesting guy. He's the guy who founded the Esalen Institute out here on the West Coast, which led to a whole explosion of interest in what broadly would be characterized as human potential. And he was very interested in sport himself and became a long distance runner.
Mm-hmm.
But I digress. What about the role of visualization in what you do? Does that play much of a role?
It does. I would like to mention that most people have a misunderstanding of really what sports psychology and mental coaching is all about. They often think of it as goal setting and visualization, and that's primarily what we do. And that's really, really far from the truth in terms of what I do. But there is a place for it. It's probably only about 5%, maybe 5% of what I do with athletes.
Mm-hmm.
But visualization really was popularized by Jack Nicklaus, you know, and how he, in his books, described how he would go to the movies in his head. But there's been a lot of research out there done on visualization from the academia side. What's important from my perspective in terms of visualization, that athletes perform not just with visual images, and visualization kind of implies a visual type of image. There's many, many images that athletes use to perform, from kinesthetic or feel-oriented images to auditory images, tactile images, for example. And I like to use the term imagery or mental imagery rather than visualization, because it doesn't, visualization to me seems like it's more, has just more of a visual component to it.
Too narrow.
An athlete, too narrow.
Yeah. Yeah, so you get the person to really imagine themselves fully into the situation with all of their senses?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. When I was at Cal State Fullerton, working with a guy named Ken Revizza, who's another kind of one of what I consider one of the fathers of modern sports psychology, we used to do some studies with the gymnasts, which they had a very high, you know, very high level collegiate gymnastics program there, and Dr. Revizza would work with the gymnasts quite often, and I would go around with them to help out. And we did a study looking at real time visualization and found out that the best gymnasts were able to visualize their beam routine, for example, to approximate closer real time of what would actually happen during a beam routine. So that was a little interesting finding that we did in a study when I was in my master's program at Cal State Fullerton. This was back in the mid-80s. I was at Cal State Fullerton studying with Ken Revizza. But there's been a lot of research done in that area of mental imagery and visualization. It seems like that's the rep that sports psychology, that the layperson knows that it's all about visualization and goal setting, and it's really not.
Yes, I think you're right about that. I think that's probably was a lot of the impression that I have as well. It's kind of interesting what you're saying about real-time visualization or imagining. I sort of tried, I was studying Tai Chi, and I would try to, maybe when I was laying in bed or something, to visualize or re-experience going through the Tai Chi moves. And I found that it's really, I mean, you really have to have very good concentration to do that and not have your mind wander off into something else. I found that to be very challenging.
Yes, yes.
Talk about focus. It takes a lot of focus. Do you think that's, do you find that that's a skill that people improve on with practice?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think the most, at the basic level, it's the ability to understand what's important to focus on and then being able to immerse yourself in those cues and then fend yourself off from distractions. More or less what I called earlier is being able to refocus when you do have distractions. Concentration is very, very important in anything that people do, especially at the athletic level. You think about a racer who's going around the track at 200 miles an hour, you don't think concentration is important, and if they get one distraction, it could mean their life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, good point. Now, I know you also have a podcast. Why don't you tell us a bit about that?
We have a podcast that we've been operating for about a year. It's called Get Psyched for Sports. It's our sports psychology podcast, where we'll pick a current event or we'll pick a quote from an athlete, and we'll give a quick tip, basically, on the mental game. It's called Get Psyched for Sports, sports psychology podcast, just to educate, you know, athletes and parents and coaches out there, once again, about some of the techniques and some of the mental strategies that we're using in sports psychology.
Okay, well, as we begin to wind down here, I wonder if you have any advice for people who might be interested in becoming a sports psychologist or any universities that you would recommend that have that sort of an orientation?
If anybody's interested, the first thing that they need to do is go to the Association for the Advancement of Applied Sports Psychology and get the graduate directory of sports psychology programs.
Oh.
Now, I did my PhD at the University of Virginia with Bob Rotella, who's well known in the area of golf psychology. He's no longer there. That program went more towards, I think, exercise psychology rather than sports psychology. So I don't know if I can recommend Virginia anymore, but there's a lot of great schools out there. University of Arizona. I know Ron Smith, who I know used to be at the university there at Seattle, University of Washington. There's a lot of great universities out there that are doing applied work, and you have to decide which direction that you want to go in. The graduate directory will help you, give you an understanding of what they're doing at the various universities and what their research interests are. So you can, that's the first place you need to start if you want to go that direction. And then decide whether you're going to go through physical education or you're going to go through more of the clinical route as well. That's the very first place that people need to start.
Okay, so again, as we wrap it up here, I wonder if there's anything you didn't get a chance to say or any last words you'd like to leave our audience with.
Well, like I said, I have an MGCP program. If there's people out there that really don't want to go back to school and study sports psychology, I have a program that I teach called my MGCP certification for qualified individuals, qualified coaches, therapists, and psychologists that want, you can say, a kind of a prepackaged system and kind of learning my system and having my assessment tools and the strategies that I use with athletes. That program's been pretty successful. We're also going to do a boot camp, what's called a mental training boot camp in Orlando this summer. If anybody's interested in the mental training boot camp, they can go to peaksports.com and search for mental training boot camp. It's a two-day weekend that we're doing with athletes and coaches and sports parents. That will be a good way to kind of get your feet wet in this whole area of sports psychology.
Okay. Well, I will put a link to www.peaksports.com in our show notes. And Dr. Patrick Cohn, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.